The Voice of America presents Inside USA, a program featuring significant or interesting events, people, and places making headlines somewhere in the nation. According to a recent Gallup poll, 80% of Americans say they favor the death penalty as punishment for the most severe crimes. They say that violent criminals deserve to die as a payback for their deeds. Some argue that swift and certain executions deter others from committing heinous crimes. Opponents of the death penalty say it is inconsistent for the state to put someone to death to express its moral outrage at that person for killing someone else. Some cite studies that show that African Americans, the poor, and other minorities are more likely to be sentenced to death and executed than whites, which they say is unconstitutional. In this report, VOA's Adam Phillips examines the many legal, political, social, and moral issues connected with the ultimate punishment.
Electrocution, lethal injection, and cyanide gas have replaced even more gruesome methods for sending condemned prisoners to their deaths. Still, state executions continue to be highly ritualized affairs, involving sealed death warrants, official witnesses, front row seats for the family of the murder victim, and a clock that has run out of time. But for a growing number of Americans, capital punishment means just one thing. The finality of a violent criminal's death by execution rids society of another major threat.
I think the people in our country are genuinely afraid to be on the streets. I know I am. And I do believe that the public at large feel that if criminals were treated harshly, that it would make the streets safer.
Ann First McCluskey is the chairwoman of the Maryland Coalition Against Crime, one of many grassroots groups that have been pushing for the death penalty. In 1981, Ms. McCluskey's brother was shot dead through the heart by a man out on parole who wanted to steal the moped or motorized bike he was riding. The killer was tried and convicted of first-degree murder. He was then sentenced to death in the separate hearing that is required in all capital cases. Even though the guilt of the murderer had not been in question since the original trial, his death sentence was overturned twice on technical grounds. And in June 1993, 11 years after his crime, the man who killed Ms. McCluskey's brother in cold blood got his sentence changed from death to life in prison. She explains why this outcome enrages her.
He took a life. He should pay for it with his life. There is a strong desire to see justice carried out. I think you have to look at people's moral upbringing. If you've been brought up in a climate where you believe in punishment for sin, punishment for wrongdoing, that you have a desire to see that some penalty is inflicted, and the penalty should be equitable with the transgression. And in my opinion, as many, many other people, the penalty for murder should be execution.
An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, says the Bible. And indeed, no one can deny that simple revenge holds a powerful intuitive appeal for the loved ones of murder victims. But Ronald Tabak, the president of New York Lawyers Against the Death Penalty, does not believe that simple revenge can ever make the victim survivors whole again. He recalls what happened one Louisiana night immediately after a man he had defended was put to death.
The victim's survivors attended that execution, and they came out and they said that while they were glad he was executed, they were very angry because my client did not suffer as much in the electric chair as their daughter had suffered in being killed. In another case, the victim's survivors came out after an execution and said they were furious because nobody could guarantee them that the person who was just executed wasn't going to go to heaven. And the point is that in reality, the execution does not really provide satisfaction because it doesn't bring back the loved one to life. And in fact, it removes the source of rage that people have. But often, as occurred in this case in Louisiana, they have nothing left to replace that rage with. So now that family continues to attend every other execution in Louisiana, but they're still not satisfied.
Many death penalty proponents justify exact retribution for murder on purely social grounds. Some, like Paul Kaminar of the Washington Legal Foundation, a group that favors stricter death penalty laws, believes that executions send a message that any true civilization must make to would-be killers.
Retribution is society expressing its collective moral outrage at the heinousness and the awfulness of the murder committed by the defendant. What society does by not having the death penalty is to demean the value of innocent human life.
Some critics of the exact retribution argument for capital punishment believe that all human life has inherent worth, and that the life of even the most despised individual has dignity, which must therefore be preserved, even if the remainder of that life is lived behind bars. Many Americans who are unfamiliar with the complex legal and constitutional issues surrounding the death penalty mistakenly think that America's founders were against capital punishment. They point to what they think is the constitutional promise of an inalienable right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But this phrase comes from the Declaration of Independence, not the U.S. Constitution. Peter Irons is a law professor at the University of California at San Diego and the author of 6 books on the Constitution and the Supreme Court.
In fact, it mentions capital crimes in several places in the Constitution. And at the time the Constitution was adopted, every state had capital punishment. But the framers also added the cruel and unusual clause to another amendment, the 8th Amendment. And that clause has become the subject of debate over whether it was intended to outlaw punishments that were so cruel and degrading that they offended human decency, or whether they were simply meant to outlaw various forms of torture, such as branding and whipping.
The U.S. Supreme Court, the branch of American government which interprets the Constitution, has held much debate over whether the meaning of cruel and unusual punishment itself may have changed in the 208 years since the document was written. The central question asks whether modern-day interpreters of the Constitution are bound by what the framers actually had in mind when they wrote it back in 1787. Again, Professor Peter Irons.
The idea that the meaning of the Constitution was not frozen 200 years ago and can never be changed by modern society is really brought to light in the death penalty case, because there's no question that the framers intended the death penalty to be part of the Constitution. The question is whether over the last 200 years ago, our society has evolved to a point where it is offensive to principles of human dignity for the state to take someone's life. And the Supreme Court has never adopted that as its position. But that argument, I think, really needs more serious attention than it's gotten.
Some insist that state executions actually serve to demean the state rather than exalt its higher values. These critics claim that it is a moral contradiction for society to affirm the sanctity of a human life lost to murder by snuffing out another one, even that of a murderer.
Maybe when you look at some crimes, and some crimes are terrible that fill us with outrage, you can say, in some books of justice, these people deserve to die. But the other side of that moral question is, who deserves to kill them?
Sister Helen Prejean is a Catholic nun and the author of Dead Man Walking, which recounts her 12 years' experience on Louisiana's death row, talking with condemned prisoners and getting to know prison wardens and executioners, as well as comforting the families of murder victims.
Where else in the criminal justice system do we ever determine our own behavior or the punishment of the criminal by imitating the crime that the criminal did? When you watch it with your own eyes and watch the state putting to death someone in a very premeditated way who has murdered someone else, you realize that we are dehumanizing ourselves and bringing ourselves down to the very level of the criminal. And it necessarily involves torture, regardless of the physical method that's used, if it's by lethal injection or gas or electricity. because the torture is in condemning a conscious human being to death, who then begins to anticipate his or her death and begins to die 1,000 times before they die. The terror, the ultimate terror, is death. That's the great unknown, and we can never take away that that's what we're doing to a human being.
Many politicians and prosecutors who advocate the death penalty justify it on grounds of its perceived deterrent value. They say that more executions in the short term will ultimately mean less executions in the long term, because would-be murderers will fear for their own lives if they get caught. Bill Otis, a lawyer in the U.S. Attorney's Office, favors this argument. Mr. Otis gives an example of the psychology of deterrence from his own life experience.
Occasionally I'll be driving in traffic in rush hour. Someone will cut me off. For about 10 seconds, I'd like to get out of my car and kill them. But I don't do that. The reason I don't do that has something to do with the fact that I have a conscience that takes over before too very long. But it also has something to do with the fact that I know that if I do get out of my car and start a fight, then I'm going to have to answer in a court of law for what I do. So I restrain my behavior, and I think other people do as well if they know that they will have to answer in a court of law. Well, I think if the death penalty were applied more frequently and more uniformly, people would think about what's going to happen to them if they follow through on their plans to kill, you know, for any of the reasons that people ordinarily commit murders, to steal, to rape, or just for the sheer sadism of it.
But the deterrence theory is a subject of debate and disagreement, even among those who favor the ultimate punishment. In a recent Gallup poll, only 13% of those who favored the death penalty cited deterrence as their reason for doing so. Even law enforcement personnel seem doubtful that the threat of capital punishment prevents murder on the streets. When asked in a national survey to rank the death penalty among methods of preventing violent crime, 386 police chiefs put it at the bottom of the list. Still, many insist that at the least, a vigorously enforced death penalty will prevent some murderers from getting out of prison on parole only to kill again. Even opponents of capital punishment will agree that a murderer who is put to death will never kill again. But they also point out that if an innocent person is executed, that person is forever denied any possibility of future justice. As long as human judgment is fallible, death penalty critics claim, it is better not to run that risk. Of course, any person convicted who receives the death penalty despite their innocence will argue that capital punishment is a 100% failure.
If you have the ultimate penalty, you are going to kill people by mistake. And that is the danger. Because once that person is dead, you can't bring them back. You can't go out and say, I'm sorry.
Shabaka Sunyata Kwalini, or Shabaka for short, is a very lucky death row survivor. In 1973, Shabaka, an African-American, was convicted on charges of robbing, raping, and murdering the white common law wife of a prominent attorney in Tampa, Florida. Though he insisted he was not guilty, he was sentenced to death in the electric chair. It took 14 and a half years on Florida's death row before Shabaka's innocence could be confirmed and he was released.
I was confronted with the fact that some people were trying to kill me for something I did not do. Death row, we do not have color TV, closed circuit television like these politicians do when they go to jail. In 1983, came within 15 hours of being executed. I use the term executed just for the sake of argument, but to call it what it is, I came within 15 hours of being murdered, because that was exactly what I would have been, murdered for a crime I did not commit. The saddest part is, you know, people I went through it before me, doing my time, and some going through it right now.
As a black man in the South, Shabaka could be considered lucky in spite of the horror of his ordeal. He taught himself the law and was able to make his case known to civil rights lawyers. Finally, after 14 and a half years, his conviction was overturned by an appeals court. It was determined that the jail inmate that the prosecutor and the police used as a witness against Shabaka had not, in fact, witnessed anything at all. Instead, this witness had been taken by prosecutors to the murder scene and coached about what to say at the trial. The prosecutor, who is now an active judge in Florida, is thought to have framed Shabaka simply to win a conviction in the high-profile case. Mr. Shabaka was asked whether his race and the race of his victim were factors in the tragedy he was forced to live.
If you live in the United States of America, you can't help but to say yes to that. I mean, you can't expect a country to have a 300-plus years slavery as a legacy and expect that to be just forgotten in an overnight time, you know. It don't work that way. The whole judicial system is based on slave laws. You got laws in the book of the United States that goes way back to 1832. 1832, and my people weren't even considered human. So how can you ask a question like that?
Statistics indicate that in some parts of the American South, racism and corruption have played a role in whether the death penalty was sought and carried out. This seems especially true in murder cases where the defendant was black and the victim was white. Indeed, a 1990 review of 28 relevant studies by the investigative arm of Congress confirmed the existence of what was described as a pattern of evidence indicating racial disparities in the charging, sentencing, and imposition of the death sentence. One study in Georgia, for example, found that prosecutors asked for the death penalty in interracial murder cases 70% of the time, but in cases where the victim and the defendant were of the same race, the death penalty was sought only 30% of the time. Stephen Bright of the Southern Center for Human Rights is a defense lawyer who has been fighting capital punishment in southern states like North and South Carolina, Georgia, Mississippi, and Alabama for many years. He says that he has seen the constitutional rights to due process of law, adequate legal counsel, and trial by one's peers routinely and systematically violated in those places.
Anybody who's been down where I've been and seen these cases and seen prosecutors call these press conferences, I have met with the victim's family, we are going for the death penalty, watch these cases tried in courts where the judges are white, the lawyers are white, the jurors are all white, the only African-American involved in the process is the person accused of the crime. Say that race is not playing a role in that is just simply to ignore the reality.
The current surge of interest in the death penalty in America may have as much to do with politicians as it does with the people who elected them, or the homicide rate, which is actually lower than it was 60 years ago. However, most Americans will agree that crime generally has increased sharply in the past decade, and the murder rate in some metropolitan areas has reached epidemic proportions. Against this backdrop, Stephen Bright explains why capital punishment is enjoying such popularity in spite of its drawbacks.
Unfortunately, in the sort of soundbite society in which we live, the death penalty is seen as sort of the ultimate litmus test on how tough on crime people are. Today, you can't be soft on crime. Everyone is opposed to crime. All of us are. I've been a victim of a crime. I've lost people that I've known and loved as a result of crime. We're all opposed to crime. The question is, how do we best deal with it?
This week's edition of Inside USA has looked at the subject of politics, capital punishment, and the Constitution. Our program was written and narrated by Adam Phillips, produced by Bob Doty, and directed by Pat Matthews. Join us again at this time next week for another edition of Inside USA.